Hi, I'm Stephanie Lemick, and this is Building Trauma-Informed Workplaces. I am super excited. I don't know how it happens, but I have another amazing guest joining us today to chat with us a little bit about their work and also to spend some time talking about what it is like and why it is important to support LGBTQIA+ employees in the workplace and why that's important in the context of trauma-informed workplaces as well. So I am a big fan of letting folks introduce themselves. So Jennifer, first of all, thank you so much for joining us. And I would love if you would introduce yourself to our listeners.
Thank you so much. Yeah, happy to do so. So I'm Jennifer Lori. We're all friends here, so you can call me Jen as well. And I use they, them, and she, her pronouns. I'm comfortable with either. I am the chief people officer at Startout. We're a nonprofit that supports LGBTQ plus entrepreneurs. And I'm also the founder of Equitable HR Guild, which I know we're going to talk a little bit about today, but supporting HR folks who want to embed DEI into their practices.
And Jen is one of my favorite voices in the HR DEI space right now. And I feel like it will be an ongoing favorite. She has amazing content. She has amazing resources. If you are not following Jen on LinkedIn, on social media yet, definitely make sure and do that. I know I usually wait to the end to say that, but I am so excited about what you put out that I want to make sure and offer that recommendation right now. But I would love to, let's kind of dig into some of the things you are putting out on LinkedIn, especially around your work with Equitable HR Guild. And I'd love to, you know, maybe hear from you, you know, why you founded the Equitable HR Guild. What's maybe the origin story there?
Sure. Yeah. So I really founded it because it's the thing that I wish I had when I was starting out in HR. So yeah, 15 years ago, I was totally self-taught as I got started in HR. I, like many people, started as kind of an operations admin person. And then they were like, oh, can't you also do HR? And I said, sure. And just did a lot of Googling and a lot of figuring it out. I went to a few kind of trainings, one-off things, but never went through any formal program. I didn't go to school for HR. So it was very much kind of figuring it out on my own. And I would often be, you know, Googling, I would be on SHRM looking at resources, trying to figure out what's the best way to write a policy or, you know, how do I run open enrollment, all these different types of things. And I just over and over again felt like the resources that were out there were not aligned with my values. It didn't feel like it was creating the type of workplace that I really believe in and that I wanted to be creating. And some of them were really actively creating harm as well. And so over time, I kind of built up my own practice and approach to embedding DEI and equity specifically into HR. You know, and I did that through working with a lot of DEI practitioners, kind of understanding what that approach means and how to, again, figure out that intersection between HR and DEI. And it took a lot of time, but I've gotten to a point where I have a lot of resources and knowledge and information. And so just started sharing it really informally at first with peers and folks who would ask me questions, and then realized that there might be an interest in sort of a broader, from a broader audience. And so, just earlier this year, the beginning of 2024, I started posting on LinkedIn and then created Equitable HR Guild as a way of putting out sort of more formal resources. And it's sort of just developed from there. It's still very much a work in progress, trying to figure out exactly what it will be over time. But the vision, again, is to really equip HR folks who care about DEI, who care about equity, but don't know exactly how to do it practically, or might not have the resources to bring in someone to help them do it, and wanting to just create things that are easy and off the shelf and helpful.
Absolutely. I think what's, you know, so interesting is it's always fun to me to hear the stories of, you know, I ended up in HR from like an operations admin background, and it's almost like you got roped into it. Like, I feel like so many people got tricked into HR. And I was one of the people who actually did not get tricked into HR. Like, I went to school, got a degree in HR management, like did all the things. And I would even say that even with a significant amount of education specifically around HR practices, the resources have not been there for practitioners. And, you know, even early in my career, I was working for really big companies with larger HR departments. And again, still so much of the work is like, how can we do that? And if you've worked in HR for over 10 years, I feel like you've had a very like disengaging experience with like logging into SHRM and like downloading like a Word document template for like the saddest policy you've ever seen in your life. And like HR can be so much better than that. So right. I love the work you're doing because it does. It feels so much like, how do I do this? What can we do? And oftentimes HR folks are thrown into a situation either where this isn't their background, they don't have enough resources, they don't have any specialized expertise. Hey, go figure it out. It's really hard to make sure that equity focus is there when you're trying to scramble and figure all these things out. So I obviously love what you're doing so much. And I think it can make such an amazing impact because by providing these resources, I think folks overlook this sometimes. When we get the right resources to the right people to implement them within the organizations they're in, the ripple impact that we can have with those changes is really remarkable. And it really makes a difference for many people.
Right.
So obviously I'm super excited and I dare. So we brought up SHRM. We're talking
yes, about, I can't not, but yes, let's
how
go there.
Can we not, like, mm-hmm. How can we not go there? For our listeners who may not be aware, SHRM is the Society for Human Resource Management. It is the largest HR, I'm going to call it lobbying body in the US, kind of globally. It truly is primarily a lobbying body as it exists today. There's probably a whole other conversation we can have there. There's also probably a whole other conversation we can have about their CEO. But that's not what we want to do today. But a big thing that came out with SHRM recently is they removed equity from diversity, equity, and inclusion. And basically their explanation, and I'm paraphrasing, you can go and look at it if you want, but basically the explanation was, a lot of people don't like equity. Like, it makes them mad, ruffles their feathers. So we're just not going to talk about it. And we're going to talk about inclusion and diversity instead. And equity is still there, but also it's disappeared. I feel like I summed that up moderately well.
Well, I would say that's pretty accurate. Yeah, it still exists, but it's not in the words. We don't talk about it. We don't center it, but it's still there. Just amongst, you know, the air that we're in. Yes, exactly.
It's like the we don't talk about Bruno, but Bruno mm-hmm. is equity, and it's really problematic because mm-hmm. this is, again, the largest lobbying body of HR professionals. Right. And I won't even say I have a love-hate relationship with SHRM. I'm consistently disappointed with SHRM, I think mm-hmm. is really my general feeling. I've felt disappointed with SHRM, you know, as a younger career professional downloading a very sad template. I felt disappointed with SHRM in some of the trainings and courses I did earlier in career. I felt incredibly disappointed in SHRM with their response to both the COVID-19 pandemic and George Floyd and the conversation we collectively had about race in this country. They were MIA. And I would say at that point, I largely wrote off SHRM, and any kind of connection I personally have to SHRM is about supporting HR professionals. And that's been my stance. But this is a big deal. This is a big change. And I want to stop talking about it and let you, Jen, tell us a little bit about, you know, maybe your reaction, your thoughts about SHRM's We Don't Talk About Equity. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
If I could sing, I'd make it a little sassy Disney copyright infringement
a little
moment.
Jingle for us, it. Yes. I agree. I've never loved, especially national SHRM. I do actually really appreciate the state and local chapters.
Yes.
I think they're doing a lot of incredible work. And I have really struggled over the last few months with how to support that work without supporting national SHRM. So that's a whole other conversation, but just want to acknowledge that. I never really felt like they cared about equity. Like, again, looking at SHRM's resources, I never really saw equity there. It was in the title, it was in their acronym, but I didn't feel like it was actually central to the way that they approached HR. So it's not surprising. Like, I don't even know if I would say it's disappointing to me. It's just kind of like, okay, yep, you're doing what I thought you were doing. And this is sort of confirmation that this is not where your values are. But what does really concern me is that it sort of gives permission to other organizations to just not bother. Again, that sort of mindset of it's too hard, or we don't know how to do it, or we don't have the resources, or we're getting pushback. All of those sorts of things. I think, yeah, people just say like, oh, well, they're not doing it. And they're sort of supposed to be this best practice, you know, this leader in our industry. And so we don't have to pay attention to it. So it does concern me from that perspective. And then yes, the lobbying aspect, they are lobbying to our government about, you know, like labor laws and just kind of directions and priorities within the workforce. And yeah, they're a very loud voice in those spaces. And so it does concern me. Again, it's not, I don't think it's really a difference from how they were already lobbying, but again, it's sort of drawing this line in the sand that we can disregard equity, which yeah, in those spaces does concern me.
I love that perspective because I think you're speaking so well too. It's confirming what they were already doing and not really investing in meaningful change, meaningful action around equity in the workplace. And for me, it's really disheartening because I do think, unfortunately, for a variety of reasons, it's gotten hard to talk about DEI in certain spaces and especially in certain industries. But I think we can still call folks into those conversations. We can still find avenues to have the right conversations without hiding our meaning. And to me, that's always super disingenuous. I know I've probably told this story a million times now, but when I first started doing my work around trauma-informed workplaces, so many folks encouraged me to change what I called it. And I said, no, because this is what it is. And when we try and hide what we're actually doing, what we're actually speaking about, I think it does a disservice to our work. But I also think it kind of muddies the waters, lacks clarity, just a whole host of things that I think are really problematic. So I appreciate our little SHRM pivot. I love a little SHRM bad choice disparagement, but I agree with you. The local chapters, the state chapters absolutely have amazing practitioners doing amazing work. And I will always be in support of HR practitioners trying to make a difference in their workplace. So
right, exactly. Probably it's a little complicated, but yeah, I think like that's where I sort of draw my feelings on it as well.
I love it. Well, to kind of step a little bit from that conversation and talk a little bit more about, you know, Equitable HR Guild, why do you think, you know, the work of equity is so important in this moment?
I think it's partially because our workplaces are just getting more and more diverse. And I think that's, you know, two things. It's like the world is getting more diverse, which is a great thing. And also, you know, diversity is kind of the one thing everyone, not everyone, but most people can get on board with at this point of like, okay, yes, we know that diversity is the benefit to everyone. You know, again, we know that the world is getting more diverse. And so we're comfortable with the diversity piece and like the representation piece. And that's great. But it also is problematic when you're expanding, you know, the diversity of your team, you're bringing in more folks who are historically excluded and marginalized, but you're not doing the work of equity and inclusion. And so you're bringing them into this place that is, you know, exclusionary, inequitable, and there's a lot of potential harm there when you're not creating an environment that's really safe for those people and you're sort of setting them up to fail. And so I think it's just so imperative to be doing all of that work together. You can't be doing just diversity or, like we just said, just diversity and inclusion. It has to be all together. And I think equity is really, for me, at the heart of that. You need to be creating equitable practices. And really, that should happen before you're bringing in diversity. Yes. But it, at the very least, needs to be happening at the same time. So yeah, I think it's an imperative as we continue to be more and more diverse to be focusing on the equity and the inclusion piece as well.
That's amazing. You've reminded me of a story for my career, and that the representation, I think you've said that really elegantly, the representation piece, I think everyone's talking about, bought in on, likes to show it off, what have you. I remember working in an organization and they were very excited about, diverse representation in the organization. But equity was not kind of top of mind for sure as I was entering. And there was like one of the ickiest conversations I ever had as an HR leader was a board member was like, do we have any gay employees yet? We need to hire gay employees so we can have gay employees, Black. I'm like, this is not your like diversity. Like, what are you doing? Right. Like, this is such a misrepresentation. And I love when you said, really, we should be building equity first. So when folks are coming in and being part of our organization, our teams, they are set up to be successful. I think that's a huge difference. I often say this, I don't care how things look as much as I care how they feel. And to me, I think that it can be a handy way to like take a beat and think about how do your diverse employees actually feel in the organization they're in. I do want to ask you for, you know, we're saying diversity, equity, inclusion a lot. We're talking obviously about equity in the work you do. I think it's a word that gets thrown around, and maybe I'm a definition person. Everyone who listens is going to be like, I know, Stephanie, you want to just have someone define something. But, you know, would you quickly share how you would define equity for our listeners so they can kind of be thinking with that context?
Yeah, for me, equity, this isn't going to be a concise definition because it's a complex topic, but and I don't know that I have a quick definition. But for me, what it means is considering a group of individuals' different needs, which includes their perspectives, their lived experience, their circumstances, all of that. And it also includes their intersecting identities, and taking all of that into account and then making adjustments to the environment to make it better suit those needs. So again, it's thinking about like, okay, this person needs this, this person needs this. They might sort of feel like they're in conflict of each other. You know, how do we come up with a solution that's either flexible enough to meet both of their needs, or, you know, maybe it's two solutions that can be, you know, adapted to fit different people's needs. It's taking all of that into account and trying to come up with the best solution for a group of people that, you know, and any group of people is going to have some differences within them. And so trying to take all of that into account.
Absolutely. I mean, when we talk about trauma, we talk about how, you know, trauma is so incredibly unique to each individual, and it is informed by many aspects of our life, our identity, our lived experience. So in creating cultures that are trauma-informed, processes that are trauma-informed, we do need some of that flexibility. We need some of that. How can we make this work? How can we support the unique needs of individuals? I love what you said. You know, there's ways to do it that support everyone. It's not I hate and love the pie analogy. It's not pie. Mm-hmm. It's, you know, there's flexibility. There's work we can do to really ensure that everyone has what they need to be successful. I want to talk about, you know, Equitable HR Guild. Obviously, we've been alluding to the work you're doing, you know, talking about why you started doing it. I'd love to chat a little bit about, you know, what you're putting out there and what's available for folks to take a look at. I know there's some great work you've done around some inclusion guides. I love your anti-violence and victim of violence leave policy you provided. And then I know there's the inclusive EEO anti-discrimination and anti-harassment policy checklist as well. I would love to, you know, have you share a little bit about, you know, what these resources are and where folks can find them.
Sure. So, that's kind of a good sampling of the different resources we have right now, because they fall into a few different categories. So we have some inclusion guides, which really works through inclusion on kind of all throughout the employee life cycle. So like the LGBTQ+ inclusion guide talks about inclusive hiring for that community. It talks about, you know, benefits and things like transition and gender affirmation policies, things like that. So it really goes through all the different aspects is meant to sort of specifically serve that community. Of course, there's going to be intersections with other needs and communities as well, but really trying to focus on specific communities and making sure that your practices are inclusive there. And then the other types of guides we have are sort of around creating policies, again, trying to start us from a place of a little bit more equitable than those just really basic, sometimes harmful policy templates that we have out there. So they're not going to be just like plug and play, you know, this is exactly a policy that you can just put into your handbook tomorrow. But because again, equity does necessitate needing to adapt it to your workplace and the needs of your employees, but it's going to be at least a starting place for you to think about, okay, how can I create, an anti-violence policy that's going to be taking into account survivors of violence? How can I create, you know, an anti-discrimination policy that's going to be really inclusive of different identities instead of just kind of like the classic 10 that you see on every boilerplate, you know, policy. So just really trying to kind of expand like our baseline and how we're thinking about some of these practices that we do day to day and starting us from a place that's a little bit more equitable.
So fantastic. They're such great resources. I know, you know, October is Domestic Violence Awareness Month. So that anti-violence, violence leave policy is super handy, a great resource as folks are thinking about this, but also recognizing, like you said, there are so many different identities, different things that kind of all meet sometimes in these policies. And I have this old joke, and I am going to like destroy my window right now, but I feel like a lot of like old policy manuals in HR are like this, and they just like don't make any, like, it's like, here's this dog on a skateboard, drinking and smoking a cigarette. Don't do that. Like, it's right. Just, it's this, all this, it's like this list of information that no one pays attention to because you feel like you have to say it. And I really love this movement that I've seen with progressive HR leaders like yourself, really focused on how do we create policies that are meaningful, impactful, think about equity, but also really help inform our culture and help us think about how we do our day-to-day, not just no smoking dogs on roller, like no like very specific thing that's pretty straightforward anyway.
Right. So we should know some of those things. It's just a, yes, a baseline. Yeah. Yeah.
I was also excited to show my sign.
I love the sign. Yes.
It's such a good sign. It's in my window. One thing, obviously, you have this amazing perspective, amazing experience, really supporting equity as an HR practitioner, which I think is super important. What do you think in this moment, HR and other leaders get wrong most often when it comes to equity in the workplace?
Yeah, I think it's sort of already alluded to it, but I think it's that idea that equity is static and that there's like a gold standard or a best practice. And it's like, we just set up this equitable thing or equitable practice and we're done. And again, it depends on the needs, the circumstances, the identities of the group of individuals that are a part of your organization. And so it cannot be one size fits all. That's equality. And so equity just has to be more dynamic. And I think a lot of leaders sort of either aren't willing to, maybe just don't understand that, or are not willing to do the work that comes with that, and really put that into practice, which I think, yeah, again, just takes more time. You know, you have to be constantly adapting and shifting and listening, and it can't just be like set it and forget it and it's done forever. Again, needs will change over time and things might come up as it's in practice. And it takes more work, but it's a necessity of doing real equity work.
I think the most important and powerful things in the workplace constantly need reiteration, constantly need support. Someone constantly needs to be paying attention to them. Equity, culture, trauma-informed workplaces. These are things that, like you said, are not static. And I think that can seem frustrating, but also when we like reframe how we're thinking about it, it's really powerful. And I think it creates a responsive and flexible organization in more ways than just that specific arena. When we're really thinking about how can we iterate, how can we get better, how can we be more responsive as a core of how we're doing business, especially in relating to our people, I think that changes how our team interacts with flexibility and change too. And that's always something that's so challenging, is navigating change within organizations. Well, if we're constantly iterating on equity, on culture, we're getting used to change. We're getting used to not being perfect and continuing to get better all the time. So I really love that.
Yeah, it really normalizes that like continuous improvement and feedback loops and all of that, and just even listening to your employees, which are all so valuable as just practices and norms outside of equity work. So I would say don't shy away from it. I think that's something that people just don't want to get into, but it's definitely worthwhile. And sometimes the process is more rewarding than even the end result. As cheesy as that sounds.
Yeah. No, it's absolutely. It's so, that's, I love that. Also, can you hear my dog coughing?
A little bit.
She's just like standing right next to me coughing. Like, she only does this when she knows. Like, she's, I love it. She's a special little thing. Mm-hmm.
She wants to chime in the conversation. Yes,
she wants to chime in. Well, I think she is the reincarnation of Elizabeth Taylor. Okay. And like, she's beautiful. She knows she's beautiful. She's mm-hmm. a deep pain in the ass. Mm-hmm. She's been married I don't know how many times, mm-hmm. but we love her for it.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. I see this.
She's very problematic. You know, she was Cleopatra. She's. Mm-hmm. We still love her,
but still very lovable and the queen. Yes.
What advice do you have for HR and other leaders who want to do more to support equity in the workplace, but they already feel like they're stretched too thin? I feel like this is probably a common challenge.
Yep. I would say the biggest thing is don't think of it as an extra initiative or something kind of like on top of your long list to do. You really need to work on and develop your approach and sort of your lens around equity. And then it should just be a part of the way that you work, in the same way that, you know, thinking about how you're going to communicate an initiative is a part of the way that you work. Or, there's so many practices that we like bring into the way that we approach our day-to-day work. And so I think equity needs to be that. It needs to be embedded. It needs to be a part of the way you're thinking about HR, instead of like, oh, it's this whole other thing that I will get to when I can or can't prioritize, which I think, just isn't the right way to do the work anyways. And it also is way more labor intensive to do it that way. So definitely recommend just really building up that muscle and that sort of approach, which does take time, but you can improve on it over time. Again, that continuous improvement.
Absolutely. I love that. I love that perspective. And here's kind of a hot button question. This mm-hmm. is a spicy question. I'm excited for it. What's your response to folks who are currently pushing back on DEI or kind of disparaging DEI publicly or within their organizations?
I don't really have a response. I'm kind of just like, cool, okay. I mean, I think it's a minority. I think it's a very loud, very angry, very privileged minority. I just try not to pay too much attention to it. It is very real, and that like there is an actual attack on DEI. But I think it's less people doing that than are just carrying on, continuing with the work. I think there is going to be a shift in how we do the work because of some of the criticism of it. And I think that's a good thing. But the overall like take down DEI, kind of like burn it down energy, I can't bother with it. So I just don't really have too much energy to give to it. I think it's silly. Yeah.
I love that actually, because I think you're right. I think it's a very vocal, privileged mm-hmm. minority. And I think those are probably not the folks whose minds we can change.
Right.
Those are not the folks who want to be called into these conversations in these spaces. And wouldn't we rather have folks who are like, oh, I'm not so sure what this means, but like, tell me more, instead of, like you said, burn it down, which is kind of silly. It's unfortunate that it's like, this is silly, but also at the same time, incredibly harmful. But it is, it's like, why is this something that is so upsetting to you, especially when you kind of refuse to like sit down in deep understanding of the concept?
I think the backlash is people who have no idea what we're talking about when we talk about DEI. And even in their arguments, sometimes you'll see that very clearly, where it's like, this is, you know, so anti to meritocracy, and, you know, like, this is so unfair, or it's tokenism, or all these different things. And it's just very clear that you don't have, we're not talking about the same thing here. Right. And so, I agree with you. I don't think it's worth the time. I have way more energy for people who are sort of like, I'm not sure how to do this, or this is hard right now, and I'm like, not sure how to implement it. But the people who are just yeah, attacking it, I think it's just, yeah, silly is as nice of a word as I can think of for it.
It's silly. Amazing. Well, I so appreciate the work you're doing. I so appreciate you chatting with us about Equitable HR Guild. I am so thrilled to see how it continues to evolve. But just, I mean, kudos to you to making these resources available. I know 12 years ago, Stephanie would have been over the moon to have these available and have resources to kind of fight some of the good fights I felt like I had to take on my own when I was first starting my career. So kudos to you. Resources are linked in the show notes, but also certainly, as I mentioned before, make sure you're following Jen on LinkedIn. I want to pivot a little bit now and talk about something I think is super important. I know, Jen, you think this is super important as well, but you know, something that I really, you know, zeroed in on this year, especially during Pride Month, there's a lot of folks that talk about supporting LGBTQIA plus employees during Pride Month. We want to make sure we're supporting our employees all months of the year. But one thing I wanted to talk about is really how trauma-informed practices support the LGBTQIA community. And I want to kind of reference some specific statistics around the LGBTQIA community and trauma before we dive into this conversation. For our listeners, I will just know, you know, that this can be hard data to hear. We're not going to go into specifics of experience, but certainly it can be harrowing to hear, you know, the impact of trauma on the community. So please proceed with caution or maybe take a break from the podcast right now if you don't have the space currently to hear this data. But really, part of the reason trauma-informed workplaces are so important is the prevalence of trauma among LGBTQIA plus individuals. There's some pretty staggering survey information. So according to the Trevor Project National Survey on LGBTQ youth mental health from 2020, 1 in 3 LGBTQ youth reported that they have been physically threatened or harmed in their lifetime due to their sexual orientation and or gender identity. For transgender and non-binary youth, that number rises to 40%. 29% of LGBTQ youth have experienced homelessness, have been kicked out or run away. 40% of LGBTQ respondents seriously considered attempting suicide in the past 12 months from that survey. The National School Climate Survey from 2021 reported that 82% of LGBTQ plus students felt unsafe in school because of at least one of their actual or perceived personal characteristics. And 12% LGBTQ students have been a victim of sexual violence at school. So these are some of the statistics just looking at LGBTQIA plus youth in our country. When we look at the larger community, especially folks who are showing up in the workplace currently, LGBTQIA plus people are almost 4 times more likely to experience violent assault than straight people. And that can include rape, sexual assault, robbery, aggravated assault, and simple assault. Almost half, 48% of trans people say they have experienced discrimination such as verbal harassment or physical assault in the past year. The community is at higher risk of developing PTSD with prevalence estimates of up to 48% of LGB individuals and 42% of transgender and gender diverse individuals. LGBTQ plus people face structural discrimination at the local, state, and federal levels, including, unfortunately, what we have seen in recent years as a direct attack on the rights of LGBTQIA plus individuals in many different states, cities, counties. Not only discourse, but also actual laws that impact access to healthcare, access to resources. So, I mean, I'll be honest, just walking through those statistics, saying that out loud, I mean, it's tough to do. It's harrowing to hear that this is still the experience for this community. And obviously, when we think about trauma-informed workplaces, our goal is to understand the prevalence and impact of trauma and create, you know, those structures, those cultures, the processes that avoid re-traumatizing survivors and actively avoid doing harm. So this is something that is really important, I think, especially as we are in an election season in the US. This is something that's also very top of mind for folks. I would love, Jen, if you're willing to share, you know, as an HR leader and as a member of the LGBTQA plus community, why are trauma-informed practices in the workplace important to you?
Yeah, I mean, just all of that data, like, is both representative of the experience and also just the tip of the iceberg of the experience. And it just feels really hard to be a queer person just existing in the US in 2024. The nature of living is traumatic right now, and you know, has been for a very long time as well. But I think it just feels, it's happening again. It's our experience day to day. You know, so much of the news cycle is exposing yourself to, you know, hearing about the death of trans and non-binary folks and hearing about all the legislation that's continuing to come out. And so it's just kind of this constant barrage of traumatic information and experiences firsthand and, you know, of your peers and your community. And so even if we're not talking about harm that exists in the workplace, we're already coming into the workplace, obviously, with all of those experiences and all of those traumas and realities of just life. And then the workplace is also incredibly traumatic for a lot of LGBTQ plus people, especially, you know, trans, non-binary folks. A lot of times workplaces are just not set up or equipped to hold space for us and, you know, for us to like navigate things like benefits or sharing pronouns or transitioning or making just like even small adjustments to how we present in our gender. And so, yeah, I think it's to even just, I would love for more workplaces to be a neutral place where they're not causing more harm and trauma. But of course, the real vision is that workplaces could be a safe place where you know that you can be who you are and not experience discrimination and harassment and even potentially, you know, heal some of that trauma that you have. And so that's my long-term vision. That's what I would love to see more and more workplaces kind of being to LGBTQ plus folks.
Absolutely. I think you hit on something really important that, you know, the statistics I shared didn't highlight, and that, you know, members of the community are often inundated with stories, experiences that are traumatic, and that someone they know, love, care about, share an identity with is experiencing trauma. And I'm a big believer that that constant imagery, constant hearing those stories, whether we're seeing on social media or through our friend groups on the news, that absolutely contributes to secondary trauma, which has very similar impacts to our own, you know, firsthand traumatic experience, and also to compassion fatigue. And I think compassion fatigue and secondary trauma are the secret culprits in a lot of burnout that folks experience in their lives, because we are just kind of soaked dry of our internal resilience, our empathy, those things that help us kind of show up and get through those challenging times. So I love that you shared that, because I think it can be really easy for us to dismiss, oh, someone's not experiencing direct harm, they don't need additional support. Well, that's not true, because of all of the other things kind of informing our experiences, and we bring those experiences with us to work.
Right, exactly, yeah.
So would you be willing to share a positive example of support you experienced directly or maybe even indirectly in a workplace?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, honestly, most of them are really small. It's like someone just, you know, correcting someone who misgenders me, or even just seeing a policy, even though it might not, you know, impact me. I am non-binary, but I also like have access to the care that I need that mostly affirm, you know, kind of is gender affirming and those types of things. So but seeing like something like a transition policy that, you know, is really inclusive is always feels like a support to me, just like on behalf of my identity that, again, might not be showing up in that way, but is still there and on behalf of my community. I will say too, one of the biggest things is, again, like people who are just allies and who are interrupting harm and assumptions and bias. One example I can think of is I was working at a anti-violence organization. We were talking about sexual violence and survivors, and the conversation was all very much assuming that everyone we were talking about was women who were survivors, which you and I both know, like, even if we're just talking about binary gender, it's not just women, like men are also often, you know, victimized in that way. And so, yeah, someone spoke up and said, hey, can we just use some more gender inclusive language and, you know, make sure we're not making assumptions and we're not talking about this all from a binary, like a male does harm to a female, like that type of language, which was very, very common in that space. And I just felt very seen. I don't know if it was really necessarily on my behalf. I was one of the few queer people in that space, but it just felt like, okay, like someone is trying to make the space a little bit more inclusive for me and anyone else who, you know, identifies that way and might be a part of the impacts even of this conversation.
I love that. I love those small, because I think sometimes we think about allyship in like big ways. Mm-hmm. And yes, those ways are important too, but I think sometimes those small things may feel easier to let slide, or this won't make a big difference. But I mean, you're telling me from your lived experience, those sometimes small things can be the most meaningful, that it is top of mind. There is someone that wants to make a more inclusive space. I love that.
Right. Yeah. I think it's the small things too, because it just shows that someone cares and that they are like willing to take the time, even though it might not be, you know, like a huge issue of discrimination or harassment. It's just an everyday interaction. But the fact that someone would take the time to interrupt that and speak up on someone else's behalf just shows a lot of care and intentionality, which is always appreciated.
Absolutely. It is. It's very interesting. I don't think I'm that old, but I guess I've been working for over 17 years now. So I guess I have enough experience to be able to say this, but I remember early in my career, first job out of college, we had a transgender employee, and it was like, we failed as an organization. Like, I say this like in a full-throated way, that we failed as an organization to be inclusive, to do right by this individual. We were so, I think we were trying, but we were inept at navigating the nuance of supporting someone and supporting the whole organization. And that's a really disappointing moment for me in my career. And I think about how that's evolved, both as society's evolved, as workplaces have evolved, as I've evolved as a leader, like how much better we can do. You know, certainly feel like having, you know, been party to, you know, we failed as an organization. I felt much stronger in like, no, here we have to be more thoughtful about inclusion in this space. We have to talk about this. We have to do something, even if we think it's unlikely, because when someone shows up and we're not prepared, it's almost like you said earlier, if you're not doing the equity work first, you're more likely than not setting that diverse individual up to fail in your organization. But I would ask, kind of thinking of my own experience where, you know, unfortunately I learned lessons on how to be a better ally in the workplace by having situations where we as an organization, we as an HR function did not succeed. We fell down. We did not do right by a team member who needed our support. So what's your recommendation for folks who are looking to be better allies in the workplace? And what can they do right now to make a difference?
Yeah, I mean, I would say from like a sort of an organizational perspective, if you're in a position in HR or another position to be able to, you know, make a change to the way that you're operating, to your policies and practices, things like that, there's a lot you can do. There's a lot of really great resources out there. I will plug my own resource on LGBTQ plus inclusion guide from Equitable HR Guild. So that kind of walks through a lot of like very practical things you can do to change and just make some tweaks that are not huge or like, you know, cost intensive and can make a big difference. So I think there's great, great resources out there. You know, the Trevor Project has some, lots out there. So just do a little bit of research and sort of start working towards that, set an intention of improving your practices and making them more inclusive. And, you know, you won't, might not get it completely right, but even just showing that commitment and care and trying to do better for employees, I think goes a really long way. So I would say that's really big. And then on kind of more of a personal level, I think just get more comfortable interrupting when you see someone being misgendered or you hear someone making an assumption, even if like there's not a person who's affected around, you know, just interrupting those moments of kind of like harm when you can, I think is really, really critical. So just get out of your comfort zone. If you don't feel comfortable doing that now, start to do it like a little bit at a time. And then that's really big too.
Absolutely. I love that. And you're right on, practice mm-hmm. even calling yourself out. I know, I try very hard with pronouns. I don't always get it right. And then when I don't, I call myself out and we move forward. And right. I think the willingness to do that can be a huge difference maker too. So I super appreciate that perspective and definitely will link the resource in the show notes as well. I want to make sure, you know, as we're being mindful of time, kind of wrapping up, is there anything else that you really wanted to share with our listeners today before we wrap up?
I don't think so. This was really great. I feel like we got to cover a lot of things that I care really deeply about. And so, yeah, this was a great conversation. And definitely, yeah, I'm here to be a resource on LinkedIn, Equitable HR Guild. We have lots of free resources out there. So find us, follow us, and hopefully they're helpful to you as you, you know, work on being more equitable and inclusive for everyone in your workplace.
Absolutely. Yes. Go and follow Jen, Equitable HR Guild on LinkedIn. I think I'm going to set a record for most times I encouraged you to do that on a podcast. And because it's incredible work, Jen, thank you so much for your time, for your candor. This was a really amazing conversation. I think a really important conversation. Looking forward to see all the amazing work you continue to do in this space. Everyone, thank you so much for joining us for this conversation. Until next time, be well.